Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome to a deep dive. Today we're tackling something pretty fundamental, really. It shapes, well, the entire world economy, international trade. Why do countries even bother swapping stuff across borders?
It's a great question. And it's not just, about getting things you don't happen to have.
Right.
It's seen as this core driver of growth, efficiency, even potentially peace, though it definitely comes with its own set of complexity.
Right.
We've pulled together some notes covering the classic theories, but also looking at the real-world challenges.
Exactly. And our mission here, for you listening, is to try and cut through some of that noise, maybe bypass the dry textbook feel, and really pull out the most important insights. We want you to walk away with a clear grasp of the foundational ideas,
Yeah.
advantage, benefits, how trade gets priced, but also, crucially, a critical look at where those, let's say, neat theories kind of bump up against messy reality.
That's the plan. We'll start with basic why, then move into those really powerful ideas. Absolute and comparative advantage. See how trade actually expands possibilities for countries. Define what terms of trade means. And then, yeah, spend some important time digging into the, well, the significant limitations and criticisms these theories face out there in the real world.
Yeah, because this isn't just abstract economics, is it? This stuff impacts the prices you pay, the jobs that exist or don't exist, and the relationships between whole nations. So let's dive in.
Okay, so the most basic reason countries trade really comes down to, well, necessity and capability. Simply put, no single country is sitting on every single resource it needs,
Right.
nor does it possess all the best technology or, the perfect labor force to produce absolutely everything its population needs or wants, certainly not efficiently.
That makes a lot of sense, just intuitively. I mean, some places obviously have oil, others have great farmland, maybe others have very specific technical skills built up over, I don't know, generations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And our source material points to this being driven by differences in what economists call factor endowments, basically, land, labor, capital. But also, yeah, technological differences are huge.
And it's not just about production, is it? The notes mention consumer preferences too, just wanting variety.
Oh, consumer preference is massive. Yeah. Even if we could technically make something similar here, you might prefer the imported version, maybe for its specific qualities, its brand, or honestly, sometimes just for the sake of having more choice.
Sure, like French cheese or Italian cars, perhaps.
Precisely. And kind of underlying all of that are simple cost differences. It's often just fundamentally cheaper to make specific things in certain places due to, wages, resources, regulations, all sorts of things.
Okay, and that leads to what seems like maybe the most powerful driver mentioned in our notes, economies of scale.
Ah, yes, economies of scale. This is a big one. Think about it. If you're only producing for your own small domestic market, you might be quite limited in how efficiently you can operate.
Right, your factory size is limited, your processes.
Exactly. But if you can sell globally,
Yeah.
suddenly you're producing for a much, much larger market. You can ramp up production, invest in bigger, better machinery, specialize your labor, and all that lets you become much more efficient, significantly lowering your cost per unit.
So producing for the world makes you cheaper per item.
That's the idea. And when you put all these factors together, the resource differences, tech differences, preferences, costs, scale economies, it leads countries sort of naturally towards specialization.
Focusing on what you're relatively good at.
Focusing on what you can produce relatively well, or perhaps relatively cheaply compared to others. And the theory goes that's the path to increasing overall efficiency and economic welfare globally.
And that idea of specializing, that leads us right into these core economic concepts of advantage, doesn't it?
It does. We usually start with absolute advantage. Now, this one is pretty straightforward, actually. A country has an absolute advantage in making a good if it can simply produce more of it using the exact same amount of resources like labor or capital as another country. It's purely about who's more productive.
Okay, so like the example in our notes, if country A makes, say, 10 shirts with an hour of labor, and country B only makes 6 shirts with that same hour of labor.
Then country A has the absolute advantage in shirts. Simple as that. They're just, well, better making shirts more productive.
Got it. Straightforward enough.
Precisely. But here's where things get really, really interesting. And honestly, a bit counterintuitive for a lot of people. It's the concept of comparative advantage.
Yes, the famous.
This is the idea that's often seen as the true engine explaining why trade can be mutually beneficial. Even, and this is the key part, even between countries where one is just flat out better at producing everything.
Even if one country has an absolute advantage in all goods.
Yes, And it all hinges on something called opportunity cost.
Okay, right. Opportunity cost, what you have to give up to do something else.
That's the absolute key. Comparative advantage isn't about who's best overall. It's about who gives up less of something else when they choose to produce a particular good.
Okay, maybe we should use an example like the one from the notes.
Yeah, let's do that. Imagine country A can use its resources to make either, say, 10 shirts or 5 computers. And country B, with the same amount of resources, can make either 6 shirts or 2 computers.
Okay, so in this case, country A can make more shirts and more computers than country B. So A has the absolute advantage in both.
Correct. Absolute advantage in both. But now, let's look at the opportunity cost for each country.
Right.
For country A to make 1 computer, how many shirts does it have to not make?
Well, it makes 10 shirts or 5 computers. So 1 computer costs 2 shirts. 10 shirts, 5 computers.
Perfect. And what about making 1 shirt? What's the cost in computers for country A?
That would be 5 computers divided by 10 shirts.
Right.
So half a computer.
Exactly. Okay, now country B. It makes 6 shirts or 2 computers. What's its opportunity cost of making 1 computer?
6 shirts divided by 2 computers. That's 3 shirts. So making 1 computer means giving up 3 shirts for country B.
Right. And the cost of 1 shirt for country B?
That's 2 computers divided by 6 shirts, which is 1/3 of a computer.
Okay, stop there. Now compare. Who gives up fewer shirts to make a computer?
Country A gives up 2 shirts. Country B gives up 3 shirts. So country A gives up fewer shirts.
Right. So country A has the comparative advantage in making computers because its opportunity cost is lower. Now, who gives up fewer computers to make a shirt?
Country A gives up half a computer per shirt. Country B gives up only 1/3 of a computer per shirt. So country B gives up less.
Exactly. So country B, even though it's less productive overall, has the comparative advantage in making shirts because its opportunity cost for shirts is lower than country A's.
Wow, okay. So even though country A is better at making both things, it's relatively more better at computers, you could say. And country B, while worse at both, is relatively less worse at shirts.
That's a great way to put it. Country B sacrifices less computer production to make shirts compared to country A. And that difference in opportunity costs is what creates the potential for mutually beneficial trade.
That really is profound, isn't it? Trade isn't just about who's the absolute best. It's about these relative strengths and, crucially, what you have to give up to produce something.
That is the core insight of comparative advantage. Absolute advantage tells you who produces more. Comparative advantage tells you who produces something more efficiently relative to their own other options.
So a country can have absolute advantage in, well, everything, hypothetically.
Yes.
But it can't have comparative advantage in everything.
No. Mathematically, if opportunity costs differ between countries, each country must have a comparative advantage in something. Mm-hmm. And if they specialize based on that and trade, both can end up better off.
Which leads us perfectly into the benefits that come from the specialization and from freer trade in general.
Right. When countries actually focus on producing the goods and services where they have that comparative advantage, the total global output of everything tends to increase.
More stuff overall.
More stuff overall. Resources get used more efficiently across the board, and that generally leads to higher economic welfare, potentially for everyone involved, though we'll get to the caveats on everyone.
Okay. And our notes mention several key benefits specifically linked to reducing trade barriers, things like, you know, tariffs, import quotas, subsidies that distort trade. What are some of those?
Well, a big one is increased competition. When domestic industries have to compete with imports, it puts pressure on them to innovate, become more efficient, maybe lower their own prices.
So it keeps local firms on their toes.
You could say that, yeah. And that competition, combined with just having access to goods produced efficiently elsewhere, often translates into lower prices for consumers, which is usually popular.
I bet. More choice, too, presumably.
Definitely. Much more variety. Goods from all over the world become available, not just what your local economy happens to produce well.
And thinking bigger picture on a national level.
Well, focusing on and expanding those export industries where you do have a comparative advantage can become a significant engine for economic growth. We talk about export-led growth sometimes. It can boost GDP.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, there's a way to visualize these gains, right? Something called the trading possibility curve.
Yes, the TPC. It's a useful concept. You probably know about the Production Possibility Frontier, the PPF.
Yeah, that curve showing the maximum mix of goods a country can produce with its own resources.
Exactly. Well, the Trading Possibility Curve, or TPC, shows the different combinations of goods a country can consume if it specializes according to comparative advantage and then trades with other countries at a certain rate.
And the key point?
The key point is that the TPC lies outside the country's own PPF.
Ah, so trade allows you to consume beyond your own production limits.
Precisely. You can reach combinations of goods more imports. Essentially, that would be impossible to achieve if you only relied on domestic production. That gap, that space between the PPF and the TPC, represents the tangible gains from trade. You literally get access to more stuff.
More stuff. That seems like a clear benefit.
It is. Now, of course, while all this trading and specializing is happening, countries need a way to figure out the price of the exchange, so to speak. How much of our exports buy? How much of their imports? And that brings us to the terms of trade.
Okay, the terms of trade, or TOT. What exactly does that measure? How is it calculated?
So the TOT measures the rate at which a country's export goods exchange for its import goods. The standard calculation, as our notes show, is basically an index. You take an index of your average export prices, divide it by an index of your average import prices, and then multiply by 100.
Okay, so it's a ratio of export prices to import prices, indexed to some base year usually.
Exactly. So if that final number, the TOT index, is, say, 110.
That means my export prices have gone up 10% relative to my import prices, compared to whenever that base year was.
That's right. Or perhaps your import prices have fallen relative to your exports. Either way, a TOT index above 100 generally means an improvement compared to the base year. You can effectively get more imports for the same physical volume of exports you're sending out.
So an improving TOT means your country's purchasing power on the world market has increased.
In essence, yes. You can acquire more foreign goods with a given amount of effort producing your own export goods.
What kinds of things cause this ratio, this TOT, to shift around?
Oh, quite a few factors. Yeah. Big ones are obviously changes in global demand and supply for the specific goods you export or import. If the world suddenly wants a lot more of your main export, its price might surge, improving your TOT.
Makes sense.
Domestic inflation can also play a role. If your internal prices rise faster than global prices, your export price index might go up, which could look like an improved TOT, though there might be other issues there.
And exchange rates must be critical here.
Absolutely huge. Think about it. If your currency depreciates, becomes weaker.
My exports get cheaper for foreigners to buy, but imports get more expensive for me.
Exactly. So the price of your exports in foreign currency terms falls, while the price you pay for imports rises. This generally worsens your channel. Terms of trade. The export price index falls relative to the import price index.
And if my currency appreciates, it gets stronger.
It's the reverse. Your exports become more expensive for others, imports become cheaper for you. That tends to improve your terms of trade. Of course, trade policies like new tariffs and big technological changes that affect production costs and global prices also feed into this.
Okay, so an improving TOT, let's say, goes from 100 to 110. That sounds like it's always a good thing, right? You get more imports for less export effort.
Generally, yes, it's viewed positively. It means more imports can be bought with the same export volume, which boosts national purchasing power. It could even help reduce cost push inflation if import prices are falling relative to export prices.
But is there a downside?
Well, our source material adds an important nuance. What if your TOT improves, not because your export prices rose due to high demand, but because the global price of your main export is actually falling due to weak demand? But maybe your import prices fell even faster. The index number might look better per unit, but if you're selling a much smaller volume of exports now because no one wants them, your overall trade balance and national income could actually suffer.
Okay. So the reason for the change matters, not just the number itself.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And conversely, a worsening TOT, say it drops from 100 to 90, is usually seen as negative.
Because I have to export more just to buy the same amount of imports I got before.
Exactly. You have to ship out a larger volume of your goods to afford the same volume of foreign goods. This effectively reduces the real income you get from your export sector. And this can be particularly challenging, even devastating, for countries that rely heavily on exporting primary commodities like agricultural goods or raw materials, where prices can be very volatile and sometimes trend downwards over time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, speaking of things like exchange rates affecting trade balances, our notes briefly mention a couple of related concepts, the Marshall-Lerner condition and the J-curve effect. Maybe we can touch on those.
Sure. These are important sort of real-world complexities when thinking about how currency changes impact trade. The Marshall-Lerner condition deals with whether a currency depreciation will actually improve a country's trade balance in the long run.
It's not guaranteed.
It depends on how much the quantity of exports and imports changes in response to the price changes caused by the depreciation. Economists call this price elasticity of demand.
Okay.
The condition basically says, a depreciation will only improve the trade balance if the demand for exports and the demand for imports are sufficiently responsive or elastic to those price changes. Specifically, the sum of the price elasticities of demand for exports and imports needs to be greater than one.
So if demand is very inelastic, meaning quantities don't change much when prices change, then making your currency cheaper might not boost your export sales enough or cut your import spending enough to actually make the trade balance better.
Exactly. You might just end up getting paid less for roughly the same amount of exports and paying more for roughly the same amount of imports, making things worse initially.
Which sounds a bit like the J-curve.
Precisely. The J-curve effect captures the timing of how the trade balance responds to depreciation. The idea is that right after a currency depreciates, the trade balance might actually worsen for a period.
The dip in the J.
That's the one. Why? Because import prices often rise almost instantly in domestic currency terms, but export and import volumes take time to adjust. People might have existing contracts, or it just takes time for buyers and sellers to find new deals or change their habits. So demand is often quite inelastic in the short run.
So you pay more for imports immediately, but your export boost hasn't kicked in yet.
Right. But then, over time, maybe several months or even a year or two, as those contracts expire and people adjust to the new relative prices, demand becomes more elastic. Export volumes hopefully start to rise because they're cheaper for foreigners, and import volumes hopefully start to fall because they're more expensive domestically.
And the trade balance starts to improve, tracing the upward curve of the J.
That's the theory of the J curve. It highlights that the positive effects of a depreciation on the trade balance might not be immediate and could even be negative initially.
Okay, so we have these powerful theories explaining why trade happens, differences in endowments, technology, scale, and how it benefits nations through comparative advantage, specialization, expanding consumption beyond the PPF.
Yes, very elegant and powerful theories. But, and this is a huge but that our source material rightly emphasizes, these theories are often built on some pretty simplified assumptions. And when we try to apply them directly to the messy, complex real world, well, significant limitations and problems quickly appear.
Right. This is crucial. We need to understand the foundations, but also where they fall short. Let's dig into those limitations. The notes list several unrealistic assumptions that the basic models often rely on, like, for instance, assuming there are no transport costs.
Yeah, which is obviously not true. Getting goods from country A to country B costs money, shipping, insurance, logistics. These costs can be substantial, especially for, you know, bulky, low-value goods, or for countries that are geographically remote. They can easily eat into or even completely wipe out a calculated comparative advantage.
Okay, what else? The assumption of full employment.
Another big one. The basic models often assume all resources, particularly labor, are fully employed. But real economies go through cycles, they have recessions, unemployment exists. If you have unemployed workers, the opportunity cost of shifting them into an export industry might be much lower than the simple model suggests, changing the calculation.
And what about moving resources between industries? The models assume perfect mobility.
Yeah, they often assume that labor and capital can just frictionlessly shift from a shrinking import competing industry to a growing export industry.
Yeah.
But in reality, that's incredibly difficult.
You can't just turn a coal miner into a software engineer overnight.
Exactly. Skills aren't transferable. Capital equipment might be specialized and useless elsewhere. People might be geographically rooted and unwilling or unable to move. Labor and capital are often very sticky.
Okay, and perhaps the biggest one we see in the real world, the assumption of no trade barriers.
Right. The pure theory assumes free trade. But reality is full of tariffs, quotas, regulations, subsidies, buy local campaigns.
Yeah.
Governments constantly intervene in trade.
For all sorts of reasons, yeah. Protecting domestic jobs, national security, raising revenue, sometimes just political leverage.
Absolutely. And whatever the reason, these barriers directly interfere with the free flow of goods that would be dictated by pure comparative advantage. They distort the patterns of trade.
What else? The notes mention assuming products are identical. Homogeneous.
Yes. The basic models often treat, say, wheat as wheat or cars as cars. But in the real world, consumers care intensely about branding, quality differences, reputation, features. A car from Germany isn't seen as a perfect substitute for a car from Japan or Korea, even if they're in the same technical class. Product differentiation is huge.
So competition isn't just on price, it's on all these other factors too.
Definitely. And linked to that, the models often assume static technology and consumer preferences.
Which is clearly not true. Tastes change, new inventions happen.
Constantly. Technology evolves, creating new advantages or eroding old ones. Consumer demands shift. The whole competitive landscape is incredibly dynamic, not static like in the simple models.
And one more assumption from the list. Constant returns to scale. What does that mean, and why is it limiting?
Constant returns means if you double your inputs, you double your output. But in many real-world industries, especially manufacturing, we see increasing returns to scale or economies of scale like we discussed earlier.
Doubling inputs more than doubles output.
Exactly. Being bigger makes you disproportionately more efficient. This tends to favor already large established producers and can lead to industries becoming dominated by just a few giant global players. It might mean that smaller countries or new entrants find it very hard to break in, even if they might have a potential comparative advantage, because they can't reach that minimum efficient scale. It complicates the simple, everyone specializes story.
Okay, those are some major cracks in the assumptions underlying the pure theories, but the notes also list broader criticisms, right? Beyond just the assumptions.
Yes. Even if we acknowledge the assumptions are simplified, there are further critical issues when we look at the outcomes of trade in the real world. A huge one is the distributional effects within a country. Meaning, even if trade makes the country's total economic pie bigger overall, the way that bigger pie gets sliced up might become much more unequal. Some groups may be owners of capital, workers in export industries might benefit hugely. But other groups, perhaps workers in industries competing with imports, might see their wages fall or lose their jobs entirely. The gains aren't automatically shared equally.
Which leads directly to the problem of a structural unemployment, doesn't it?
It does. As a country specializes according to comparative advantage, those industries that lack that advantage tend to shrink or even disappear because of import competition. The workers in those industries can lose their jobs. And even if new jobs are being created in the expanding export sectors, those laid-off workers might not have the right skills or live in the right place to get those new jobs. This can create long-term unemployment in certain regions or for certain types of workers, even if the net national employment level doesn't change much or even rises.
That's a serious social cost.
It can be very serious. Another risk highlighted is overdependence.
Specializing too much in one thing.
Exactly. If a country becomes overwhelmingly reliant on exporting just one or two primary commodities, maybe oil or coffee or copper, its entire economy becomes incredibly vulnerable to swings in the global price of that commodity. A price crash can devastate national income. Similarly, becoming too dependent on importing essential goods like food or energy creates vulnerabilities if supply chains get disrupted.
Yeah, we've seen examples of that recently. What about environmental impacts?
That's an increasingly prominent criticism. The drive to maximize production for export in areas of comparative advantage, whether it's agriculture, mining, manufacturing, can put immense strain on natural resources and lead to unsustainable practices, pollution, deforestation, water depletion. Environmental costs aren't always factored into the simple economic models of gains from trade.
Okay. And finally, our notes mention something called the Priebisch-Singer hypothesis. This sounds like a direct challenge to the idea that trade benefits all countries over time.
It is. It's a very significant critique, particularly relevant for many developing countries.
So what does the Priebisch-Singer hypothesis suggest?
It was developed independently by Raoul Priebisch and Hans Singer back in the mid-20th century. They argued that countries that primarily export primary commodities, again, think raw materials, agricultural products, tend to see their seller relations. Terms of trade systematically decline over the long run relative to countries that primarily export manufactured goods.
Why would that happen?
The reasoning involves a few factors. One idea is that as global incomes rise, the demand for manufactured goods tends to increase more rapidly than the demand for basic commodities. People buy more cars and electronics, but their demand for coffee or sugar doesn't rise proportionally. Another is that manufactured goods prices tend to be stickier and rise more steadily, perhaps due to stronger market power or unionization. While commodity prices are much more volatile and prone to long-term downward trends due to competition and technological substitutes.
Okay, and if a primary exporter's terms of trade are constantly declining, what's the implication?
The stark implication is that these countries potentially have to export ever-increasing volumes of their raw materials just to be able to afford the same amount of imported manufactured goods, like machinery or technology, needed for development.
So they're running faster just to stay in the same place, or even falling behind.
That's the concern. It can create a cycle that perpetuates poverty and hinders diversification and development in nations stuck exporting primary goods. It's a powerful real-world counterpoint to the simpler versions of trade theory that suggest comparative advantage will automatically lead to convergence and shared prosperity for all trading partners.
Wow. Okay. So quite a journey there. We started with the basic why of trade differences in resources, tech, costs, scale. We really unpacked the crucial difference between absolute and that more powerful idea, comparative advantage based on opportunity costs.
Mm-hmm. And how that leads to potential gains from specialization, allowing countries to consume beyond their own production possibilities, which we visualize with that trading possibility curve, the TPC.
Right. Then we defined the terms of trade, that ratio of export to import prices, and looked at what causes it to change and what the impacts of those changes are, touching on those complexities like the Marshall-Lerner condition and the J-curve effect for currency changes.
And then, importantly, we spent significant time critically examining the real-world challenges and limitations. Those unrealistic assumptions, the basic models make no transport costs, perfect resource mobility, no trade barriers, and so on.
And the broader criticisms, too, the fact that gains might not be shared equally within a country, the real human cost of structural unemployment, the risks of overdependence, the environmental impacts.
And finishing with that significant long-term challenge posed by the previous Singer hypothesis for primary commodity exporters.
So hopefully you listening now have a much more comprehensive picture. You understand the powerful theoretical engines driving global trade, but also the complex, sometimes difficult realities and frictions that modify how those theories actually play out in practice.
It should give you a richer, more critical lens, really, for viewing global economics, thinking about supply chains, understanding policy debates around trade deals and protectionism.
Absolutely. And maybe it leaves us with a powerful question for you to chew on, something to think about after this deep dive. Given all those limitations and criticisms we discussed, the unequal distribution of gains, the potential for real job losses and community disruption, the environmental concerns that Priebisch Singer warning about long-term trends, does free trade, as practiced in the real world, always equate to fair trade or even equitable trade for everyone involved, both within countries and between them?
Yeah, how much should those real world frictions, those distributional outcomes, those environmental costs influence how we think about and apply the elegant, but perhaps overly simple theories of comparative advantage?
Something to consider, perhaps, the next time you pick up a product that's traveled halfway around the world to reach you.